Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Nip Tuck Coach Radio, your cosmetic surgery connection. Join cosmetic surgery Nip Tuck Coach, beauty expert, and author of Safety First, A Consumer Guide to Cosmetic Surgery, Michelle Garber, your host of the Nip Tuck Radio Show. Michelle's goal is to empower listeners and help them make safe cosmetic surgery procedure choices. This fun and lively show explores the world of beauty and cosmetic surgery and features expert guests on a variety of topics. No hype. Your host, Michelle Garber, is here today to help you navigate the confusing world of cosmetic surgery.
Hi everyone, this is Michelle Garber and welcome to another week of Nip Tuck Coach Radio. I'm Michelle Garber, your host, and we are broadcasting live this afternoon from San Francisco. If you don't know me, I am founder of Nip Tuck Coach, an independent cosmetic surgery consultancy, and I'm a patient advocate. You know, there's lots of misinformation out there, and finding the right surgeon is confusing. So my goal is to keep you safe and well-informed by helping you choose the right surgeon to meet your aesthetic goals so that not only do you get a great result, but you get the best result. And to create more consumer awareness for safe cosmetic and plastic surgery procedures, I've written a comprehensive little guide called Safety First, The 10 Golden Rules for Safe Cosmetic Surgery, which you can download for free at my website, which is www.niptuckcoach.com. So today we're going to be talking about rhinoplasty. You know, rhinoplasty is very complex, and it's a true art, and it's a very important part of your facial anatomy and greatly impacts the way you look. You know, sometimes people, I think, generalize your ethnicity by your nose. You know, they say, oh, you have a Jewish nose, you have an Italian nose, you have an Asian nose, you've had a broken nose. And it also has a negative effect on your self-esteem. If a lot of people feel that their nose is too big or their nose is crooked or they have a little slight bump on their nose. So, I mean, it really is when people look at you, they see your nose. And according to the American Academy of Facial Plastic Surgery, there's been a 10% increase in rhinoplasty over the past year. And they seem to think that some of this is driven by patients are becoming more aware of how they look, and that's because of social media, taking selfies, doing videos. And according to the American Society of Aesthetic Plastic Surgery, rhinoplasty is in the top 5 surgical procedures. So today we have one of the top rhinoplastic surgeons in the world with us, Dr. David Kim. Hi, Dr. Kim.
Hi, Michelle.
You there?
Yes, I am.
And we're going to, excuse me? And we're going to discuss.
I'm here.
Okay, great. And we're going to discuss today the myths and misconceptions of rhinoplasty, what to expect, what to avoid. Dr. Kim is a double board certified facial plastic surgeon by the American Board of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery and by the American Board of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. He's also a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. He's authored over 50 articles and chapters, presented hundreds of lectures, and completed several scientific studies on the topic of rhinoplasty. Dr. Kim is viewed by those in his field as an expert and a leader in this surgery. He's a highly sought-after speaker, particularly in the area of rhinoplasty. Dr. Kim has made numerous appearances on television, radio, and in print, and at professional conferences. And Dr. Kim's practice is in San Francisco. Wow, that's a mouthful. And I said otolaryngology correct. Yay!
You did it perfectly.
So, it's great to have you on my show today. I'm excited. We're going to have a great discussion. And so let's talk a little bit about what are some of the major misconceptions about rhinoplasty today?
Well, I think one of the big misconceptions is that with this operation, you can get any nose that you want. You know, I think patients, we live in a world now where people have high standards for themselves. people are used to getting what they want. Perfectionism is on the rise. So almost every consultation, there's a big component of setting expectations. And, you know, rhinoplasty, like any surgery, there are boundaries and constraints that you have to stay within so the operation can be safe and the nose can be changed in a way that fits one's features.
So do patients come with you and bring with them pictures of celebrities and say, I want my nose to look like this? Like, do they have misconceptions of how they think their nose should be and the reality is very different?
You know, it happens. It definitely happens. You know, if you are a layperson and not having had experience in, you know, the anatomy or the surgical soft tissue, it would be understandable that you wouldn't know what was possible. And I think that many patients almost view the process of rhinoplasty as something like sculpture. You know, I think the media talks about how plastic surgery is art and how altering structures on the body or face is like sculpting. You know, rhinoplasty is not like sculpting. We're not working with a lump of clay that you can shape and mold into any shape that you want. You know, you don't stick it in an oven and it sets exactly in the way that it was molded. You know, this is living tissue. The structures are there for a purpose and a function. If you push the structures beyond their natural limitations of change, you start running into problems. You can also start running into kind of unusual aesthetic features. So, you know, you have to kind of weigh all of these based on the nose that someone comes in with. So, fortunately, I think most patients understand that coming in, or they can understand it with a brief discussion. But, you know, I have to tell you, some folks are a little disappointed that they can't get, you know, Megan Fox's nose or some other celebrity's nose if they start out with a nose that's too far of a departure from that. And if we have that honest conversation and it seems like their goals are not attainable with surgery, then, you know, it's a no-go. Then it wouldn't make sense for us to go forward.
So how do you determine the best nose shape for your patients and have this discussion?
Well, you know, that's another misconception, that there is a perfect nose for every person. You know, there's certain, you know, noses are so variable, as you pointed out in your introduction. There are differences based on ethnicity and gender and age and family features. So quite a range of noses can look good on any given person. So, you know, I try not to be too rigid about it. It's unfortunate that in a lot of plastic surgery textbooks, even in teaching programs, they really emphasize these fairly rigid guidelines in terms of measurements and ratios and distances to set what is a quote-unquote ideal nose. But those are, I think, too specific and can't be generalized to all people. You know, I think the features that make a nose look attractive are common in a lot of different types of noses, and those have to do with symmetry, number one, smoothness, number two. You don't want to see uneven contours that create a nose that has harsh highlights or shadows. And then third, a nose should have the right proportions. And that's generally a soft triangular shape, whether it's looked from the front, the side, or from the base. And I think these features allow a nose to sort of fall into the background. You know, we don't really want to create a nose that's such the center of attention. The nose does sit in the middle of the face, but I think aesthetically its job is to draw attention to the eyes and, you know, eye contact. The eyes are the way that we interact with the world socially. We don't want the nose to be the stopping point. And if a nose has a feature that's unusual, big hump, crooked, big tip, you know, those are reasons why someone may stop at the nose. So that's, in my view, the most common reason that patients seek treatment to make their nose a little bit less noticeable, less prominent, more in the background.
do you find that patients, if they have an ethnic nose, want to keep the ethnic nose a little bit or totally want to change that, not to be identified with that ethnicity? You know, like I know I'm Jewish, and I don't really have a Jewish nose because I did have some rhinoplasty, but there are, you know, people say that, oh, you have a Jewish nose, oh, you have an Italian nose. And do you think that there's a trend wanting to look more natural and keep that part of your ethnicity?
You know, it really depends on the individual. There's so much variation in motivation and attitude and philosophy about this. You know, one example, Iran is known to be an area of the world where rhinoplasty is extremely popular. And many people believe it is partly related to the culture in which women are shrouded and only their face is revealed, and so much of their femininity is based upon only that exposed part of their body. So, you know, in Iran, those original ethnic features, which typically may have somewhat of a hump on the bridge of the nose, or the tip may be a little low, kind of hooked downward. You know, those features are changed to a point where they go pretty well beyond what we typically would try to accomplish with rhinoplasty around here. And, you know, those individuals have sort of a different set of circumstances and culture that's driving their aesthetic goal. Now, when I see Persian American patients who are Americanized, who have grown up around in this area, particularly in Northern California, their motivations seem quite different. You know, they may anatomically have the same nose because they come from the same genetic pool, but these patients that I see here, they're more apt to want a straighter bridge rather than a bridge that's a little sloped or scooped. They may want a tip that's in more of a neutral position rather than one that's raised up. You know, they may want more sort of natural changes. So, you know, both of these examples, you could say that they're becoming less quote-unquote ethnic, but it's, you know, there's so many complicated factors that can play into how far someone wants to go. So this is just one example, and, you know, there are hundreds of other scenarios where different people can sort of prioritize differently.
So I wanted to touch a little bit on body dysmorphic disorder, because I think that that also plays a role in how you see yourself and what your expectations are when it comes to a cosmetic surgery. So what are some of the danger signs that you see sometimes in patients, and how do you treat those patients?
Well, it's a really tough patient to work with. You know, these patients tend to most desperately want the procedure, but, you know, this group of individuals may never be happy with the outcome from the surgery. The way I look at it is patients with body dysmorphic disorder put a disproportionate amount of anxiety and dislike and distortion to some body feature that bothers them. And it often originates from some childhood trauma or teasing that kind of creates this, and that injury or hurt grows with them. So by the time, you know, they reach a certain age and have the resources to start thinking about it, it becomes their obsession. And the problem is surgery, no matter how well it goes, no matter how skilled the physician is, can never result in perfection. You know, that's in God's hands, not in the hands of a surgeon. So we can create significant, dramatic improvement, but there's likely to be some tiny little imperfection, and that is the case with every single surgery. The patient with body dysmorphic disorder will see that imperfection and blow it up in their mind and magnify it, and they'll replace their anxiety about the big hump that they used to have with the small contour imperfection that most patients wouldn't be bothered with. So, you know, I, like most plastic surgeons, the goal is to try to create a change that makes someone happy and that makes someone feel good about themselves or glad that they did it. In this patient population, it's kind of a losing battle, so it's best to try to avoid that situation.
What are the danger signs that you see in patients that you think may have this disorder?
Well, you know, one of the signs is a distorted sense of the problem. Often patients with BDD would come in with a relatively small deformity, and the type of feelings that would be expressed to me would be things like, you know, I can't leave the house. I can't stand to look at myself. I'm embarrassed to talk to people. I know that everybody's looking at my nose. You know, if I don't have this change, I can't go on living. I mean, it's that type of dramatic emotional language that is, and behavior and attitude that I see with body dysmorphic disorder. Now, I think that body dysmorphic disorder is a label that we put on a condition, which is a really extreme example of someone who is, you know, having a very extreme and difficult time coping with some issue that they've had. I think the reality is it's a little bit on a spectrum. You know, I think that there are patients who you wouldn't call full-blown body dysmorphic disorder, but there is some tinge of the sadness or this heightened emotional sensitivity that makes that individual a little harder to please. And, you know, it's not a far stretch from sort of perfectionism. You know, I think we live in a high-functioning area. A lot of patients expect a lot from themselves and from others. And, you know, I think sometimes patients get a little wrapped up in things having to be just right or being sort of disappointed. And, you know, I find some patients who one may not say, this person has full-blown body dysmorphic disorder, they have sort of an exaggeration or distortion of small problems, which they build up to be a little bit bigger. And, you know, as a surgeon, you have to be a little on guard about that because, again, you want patients to focus on all the positive changes and improvements that happen and not on inevitable slight little imperfections that happen with every surgery.
So how do you counsel patients in terms of managing their expectations after surgery? And does the nose change after surgery? And so they, what do you tell your patients?
Yeah, I think I try as hard as I can to manage their expectations before surgery. Because if I feel I can't manage their expectations in a way that's realistic, then it's not a good idea to go forward. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion. I try to be very specific about what it is they're hoping to achieve and what the outcomes are likely to be. I have some nice advanced equipment in the office. We have a digital camera suite. We have both two-dimensional and three-dimensional computer software imaging that allows me to change the photos and the 3D pictures so that patients can have a sense of what I can accomplish. And I try to show them a realistic change. You know, I try to sometimes patients want something that's not attainable, and there's no point in me showing that. But so I try to show them realistically what I think we can attain, you know, that is within the range of hopefully what they want. And if after that discussion that patient seems that is not going to make them happy, or if they seem like an individual who would not be able to bear the thought of any little problem, then, you know, we sort of try to gently steer them away from the procedure or have them sort of put on the brakes and reevaluate. I try to do this as a service, as a favor to patients, because I don't want to put anybody through any turmoil, and as a surgeon, I don't want to have to work with a patient who is going to be unhappy and upset. You know, that's not what I signed up for. So I see new patients for rhinoplasty in a one-hour appointment. I think, easily 30 minutes of it is about this kind of stuff, about talking about expectations. It's as or more important than actually talking about the nuts and bolts and details of the surgery.
Yeah, because nothing is guaranteed, and sometimes you go in there and do you find structures or something about the anatomical aspects of the nose that you didn't know you were going to encounter?
Well,
that
can
change an outcome?
Fortunately, I've been doing this for a long time, and as a rhinoplasty specialist, I do almost all noses, so I've seen a lot. With primary rhinoplasty for someone who's never had surgery before, you can tell a lot based on your examination and your analysis. So there's not a lot that surprises me at this point. In revision, it can be a little different. If somebody's had a bad rhinoplasty and things have been botched and the structure has been compromised and the skin is scarred or damaged, sometimes when you find yourself at the time of surgery, things can be a little worse than you expected internally. But fortunately, with experience, you know how to deal with different situations on the fly. And, we generally can make a significant improvement even if the plan has to change a little bit at the time of surgery.
So how do you ensure that the problems don't develop after surgery?
Well, in fairness and in honesty to patients, you can't tell them that there's a 0% chance of a complication or a problem. That would be dishonest. We can minimize the risk of those problems by following safe protocols and preparations that are sort of, the standard of care for patients. So for general health, we wouldn't want to operate on anybody who has any medical conditions or, patients who are a little older. We encourage them to see their primary care physician to get cleared to make sure they're safe for surgery. We have patients do blood tests, an EKG, if they have any risk of heart issues, to try to minimize the risk of any medical complication. We only use accredited operating rooms or surgery centers, with high-quality anesthesiologists. So I think those things represent just about everything we can do to minimize medical risk. Now, in terms of surgical risk, something bad happening in terms of the results, that really depends on the skill and, how meticulous the surgeon is. And, rhinoplasty can be done in so many different ways. And unfortunately, as an operation overall, when you look at the statistics nationally, there's a slightly higher rate of irregularities or imperfections that prompt people to have revision than in some other surgeries. But I think, going with a rhinoplasty specialist who has a broader experience to draw from, you're going to have a safer bet of avoiding those type of problems.
So what are the you had said that actually noses change after surgery. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, well, noses change anyway. So even without surgery, particularly if the nose is a little heavy, if the tip is a little wide or droopy, the tip tends to drop a little more, and the tip can sort of widen as it settles in a little closer to the face. Now, that can happen as well after a rhinoplasty if that part of the nose hasn't been stabilized. It's really all about structure and stability. So in the unoperated nose, the nose where, somebody who's never had surgery, the gradual effects of gravity, those are the main forces that are causing the nose to change. the difference after surgery, because the skin is separated from all of the bone and cartilage, which are the targets of the surgery, that's what we're changing. The skin goes through this ongoing wound healing, which happens through a process called contracture. So you can almost picture a shrink wrap effect, just like a frozen dinner where the plastic is really wrapped down onto the container. And you imagine that process happening for months and even years after a rhinoplasty. So in addition to the gravity effects, you have the shrink wrap effect that's causing the skin to contract. And if the structure inside the nose isn't left strong, that shrink wrap can cause collapse of structures, it can cause pinching, it can cause deformity, it can cause the nose to twist in different directions. So you know, all that structure has to be stable in order to minimize that risk.
So how do you stabilize the structure?
Well, you know, modern rhinoplasty, in my view, is an operation where we're making changes while making the nose stronger. And the basis of structural rhinoplasty is to use material that comes from one's body. The material that I use, which I think is the best material, is cartilage. And we obtain cartilage either from within the septum of the nose, which is the wall that separates the two sides of the nostril. Sometimes we can obtain some from either the ear or the rib, depending on the needs. And those structures are used to create and carve small grafts, small geometric shapes of the cartilage that can be inserted and placed inside the nose to cause the existing structures in the nose to conform to a different shape. You know, plastic surgery, the word plastic means change. So we're creating change in the nose by reinforcement with the structure. Now, this is not how rhinoplasty used to be done. You know, for decades, rhinoplasty was mainly a surgery of reduction. Rhinoplasty would be an operation where the surgeon would look at the nose and say, hey, this is too big. So what I'm going to do is just start cutting things out, starting to divide and weaken tissue so the nose would start to settle inward, become narrower or smaller. The problem is the nose was weaker. So even if it was smaller, that weakness created a situation where the nose might look good for a while, but if you're one of these unfortunate patients who, you know, had a lot of scar contracture of the skin, the nose would keep changing and shrinking even after the point it looked good. And then you'd end up with one of these pinched noses that can't breathe, you know, one of these noses that look a little fake, and, you know, that's no fun.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, we have a couple minutes left, and I do want to touch on the subject of the trends of fillers to augment the nose non-surgically, such as silicone, radius, Voluma. What is your opinion about this?
Well, you know, this might be a little controversial because a lot of people use fillers in the nose. You know, dermatologists, plastic surgeons, a variety of physicians. I think it's you know, a bad idea. Filler is a safe product, I think, if it's an absorbable filler used in the right part of the body. But in the nose, because of its proximity to the dirty space inside the nasal passages, because of some differences in the skin that overlies the nose and the blood supply, there's a higher risk. If a filler gets injected into a blood vessel, that can cause the skin to die, and that can happen anywhere, you know, anywhere a filler is placed. Now, the risk of that is very low in other areas of the face. Now, in the nose, it's a little higher. What's even worse is this trend of permanent fillers. So Artifil is a new filler FDA approved in the U.S. Internationally, there are a lot of other permanent fillers. These fillers that are permanent can cause permanent problems. You know, a small percentage of patients don't tolerate it. Their immune system goes after it. It sort of acts like a foreign body that the body is trying to get rid of. And unlike a solid implant, a gel filler can't easily be removed. So I've seen numerous disasters from that type of fill with a permanent filler.
You know, patients should really think twice about before they start doing fillers for non-surgical rhinoplasty. We're running out of time, Dr. Kim. I want to tell listeners how they can reach you. Dr. Kim's website is www.dwkimmd.com. And Dr. Kim, you're also on Google Plus and Facebook and Twitter. Is that right?
That's correct.
And thank you for listening to Nip Tuck Coach Radio. If you missed any episodes, they're available for download on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio Nip Tuck Coach. And have a wonderful weekend, and we will talk to you next week. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the Nip Tuck Coach Radio. Join us next week for another exciting program about the world of cosmetic surgery and beauty. To learn more about Michelle Garber, go to www.niptuckcoach.com. To consult with Michelle directly, call 415-494-7211.